Welcome to the Inspirational Tales podcast. We all experience hardships and obstacles in our lives, but it is how we choose to respond to these events that can shape our present and future years. When my guests on this podcast experience the most challenging times of their lives, they use these hardships to learn, grow, and better themselves, and as a result, they are now thriving in life. Their stories are ones of resilience, strength, and overcoming adversity. So sit back and join me as we celebrate them turning their challenges into triumphs. My guest today is Lisa Cox. At the age of 24, Lisa contracted an infection which led to her having a brain hemorrhage stroke. She spent 3 weeks on life support, 2 months in a coma, died and was resuscitated twice, and spent over a year in hospital. She required multiple surgeries, including the amputations of her leg, fingertips, and toes, open heart surgery, and a total hip replacement. She also developed epilepsy and was left partially blind. But Lisa did not let any of this stop her from living her life to the absolute full. She is now a disability advocate, a model, a published author, and a professional speaker. She has taken on her challenges headfirst and now works tirelessly for disability inclusion, particularly in the fashion and media industries. Lisa is such an inspiration, and I hope you enjoy hearing her story. Hi, Lisa. Thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
Hey, I'm really good, thanks. Great to be here.
Oh, that's great to hear. I know I said this to you just before we started recording, but you were actually one of the very first people I wanted to have on this podcast because I think your story is absolutely incredible and the amount of challenges that you've faced and yet you've come through and you're living such an incredible life. It's so inspiring, I think. So thank you for coming on today. So can we start back at the beginning before you had your brain hemorrhage or stroke? So can you take us back to your early 20s and explain to us what your life was like back then?
Yeah, sure. And it was pretty good and pretty normal, to say the least. I'd finished school and uni here in Brisbane, got my degrees and headed down to Melbourne and started working in advertising and was working in an advertising agency down in Melbourne doing what a lot of 24-year-olds are doing, I suppose, working too many hours, drinking probably too much wine, trying to climb the corporate ladder and doing all of the usual things, dating some bad people and making some bad decisions and loving life generally, burning the candle at both ends and probably working a bit too hard, trying to climb the corporate ladder. Then it all turned a bit pear-shaped on the 22nd of Feb 2005 when I was at Melbourne Airport one morning and tried to get onto a plane when apparently, and I say apparently because I have no recollection of that moment. I've got amnesia or memory loss from a few months before and after the brain hemorrhage. I was slurring my words and collapsed at the airport and had the stroke. So they took me an ambulance took me to the hospital. I spent the next 3 weeks in a coma, 2 months on life support, and over a year in hospital after that.
So during that year, you had multiple surgeries and a whole heap of things happen. Can you take us through what happened in that year and how it was for you, the part that you remember?
Yeah, so I don't remember the first few months, firstly because I was in a coma, but after I had that, I was on a lot of medication, pain relief medication, also anti-seizure medication because of the brain injury. I still have a permanent brain injury today, but I was fitting and convulsing in the bed, so had to be, I suppose, tied down or strapped down to the hospital bed, I suppose, to stop me convulsing. So I was on medication for that, and my hands and feet were quite literally rotting away because of the sepsis. They were all turning black, my hands and my feet. So surgeons originally talked about amputating both hands and both feet. So the fact that I only lost fingertips and toes and one leg is pretty awesome, to be honest. And I mean, that sounds a bit weird, but considering what was going to happen and what ended up happening, they're obviously very different things. So in the end, my left leg, all of my right toes and none of my fingertips were amputated. I still have my left thumb. I had heart surgery twice and a total hip replacement. Sorry, they're all of the visible disabilities and things you can see, I suppose. But the biggest challenges in my life, or most of them, don't come from my wheelchair, my missing fingertips and my prosthetic leg and all the stuff you can see. It comes from all of the invisible disabilities and things that you can't see. So today I'm over 25% blind. I have chronic fatigue, peripheral neuropathy, which is a fancy name for chronic pain in my right foot. I have sort of permanent pins and needles, I suppose. Chronic fatigue. I know you and I spoke before the episode about chronic fatigue.
Yeah, it's fantastic, isn't it?
It's so much fun. So if I fall asleep during this episode, you know why. I'm not an evening, afternoon person. So I'm getting rid of
You're doing really well.
What else? Epilepsy. I think I spoke about that. And a whole heap of other challenges that you just don't see, I suppose. So people might think, or a stranger who doesn't know me and doesn't know my underlying invisible disabilities might think I'm just being lazy or, you know, acting bored or frustrating or something like that. But really, they're just things that are outside of my control.
That is a lot of things that have happened. I think one of those for anyone would be such a huge challenge.
Yeah.
And yet you had so many different things happen. Now, this was all, just to go back, this was caused by an infection, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So in my non-medical sort of understanding of it all, it was, what was it called, Streptococcus A. The way doctors explained it to me, I suppose, they put a lot of information in layman's terms for my family and I, who are, you know, trying to understand it all at once. And it was, I suppose, the sort of thing you can pick up maybe at a supermarket or something like that. And the way they said it to us was that, you know, normal immune systems would fight it off, but my immune system just didn't, obviously, at the time. And so it just had a big old party in my immune system, and all of my organs shut down. It caused the brain hemorrhage, of course, and once all of my organs shut down, that's when I went on life support for 2 months. So during that life support for 2 months, I was just lying in a hospital bed, being kept alive by machines for 2 months, and my heart was in in one part of the room, my lungs were in another part, and my liver was another machine, my kidneys were another machine, and it was apparently quite a sight to walk in on. My family would say, you just walk in, and there I was, being machines beeping everywhere. And yeah, so science and technology is a wonderful thing.
That sounds incredibly terrifying, but obviously you don't remember any of that part. You said, but what was your family going through? Have you spoken to them about how they felt?
I have, and I cannot imagine what they were going through. And every single day I feel terrible for putting them through that.
Oh, it wasn't your fault. You didn't want to go through that.
That's what everybody says, but I still feel terrible for it, absolutely terrible. I can only imagine, because if something happened to one of my loved ones now, mum, dad, sister, brother, my husband, I would be an absolute mess. I've said many times before that if something happens to me, I'm okay. I can handle it a lot better than if something happens to someone I love. It's very different.
What was the first thing that you remember from when you woke up?
My first sort of memory is in a hospital in Brisbane, in one of the hospitals, Prince Charles Hospital, which your listeners may or may not know. And that particular memory, by that stage, I didn't realise it at the time, but that was about 4 months after my brain hemorrhage, and I didn't realise it, but I'd already been in three or four different hospital wards. I had the brain hemorrhage and spent 2 months and was in the coma down in Melbourne, and then staff realised that I would be in hospital for quite a long period of time, and my home base was in Brisbane. All of my family's in Brisbane, and they knew I'd be in hospital for quite some time, so my family was quite literally living out of suitcases, sleeping on the hospital floor during that first 2 months, and it just was not realistic for them to continue living like that for the long term. So they knew they had to
get me back up to Brisbane for my extended stay in hospital. So they medevaced me, put me in an air ambulance, or I think it's called a Learjet, and took me up to the hospitals in Brisbane where I stayed, and my family could live or resume their normal lives or some sort of a normal life back in Brisbane, go back to their respective work and those sorts of things while I continued my hospital stays and had a lot of my procedures and operations and those sorts of things. Yeah, I have absolutely no idea how they coped, and I'm sure each of them had their own coping mechanisms. And I mean, there is no guidebook for how everyone has to cope. And if COVID has taught all of us anything, is that there is no one way for each of us to cope.
Yeah.
Not that you can compare COVID to what happened to me, but it's just, you know, everyone copes with shit differently.
How did you cope with it? Because obviously so much was happening to you. How did you cope with being told, you know, this is, you're going to have this surgery, you're going to have this leg amputated? And it was like constant one after the other. How do you cope with that?
For the first part of it, I was just so heavily medicated and so tired and such a space cadet. I was just in and out of sleep and just, yeah, letting it wash over to me. And then as I slowly came out of this deep fog, I was in a really, really deep depression, just crying all the time, and emotions were up and down and up and down. My leg was coming off. I couldn't stop crying. I didn't know what that meant. And then I met a girl who changed everything for me. Her name's Phoebe, and she knows I'll talk about her because I talk about her all the time. And I met this girl called Phoebe, and my surgeon organized for me to meet her. And Phoebe walked into my room, and I'd been told, this girl who knows what you're going through is going to come and talk to you. And I thought, oh, great, you know, finally someone who knows what I'm going through. All I've met are these, like, 60-year-old white-haired men who have no idea what I'm going through. I'm like, this little 24-year-old girl is you know, nobody understands. This absolute glamour walks into my room. I'm like, you bitch, you don't have a clue. Anyway, Phoebe sits down. Turns out she'd had both legs amputated, one arm, one hand, just like mine. I'm like, just sat there, my jaw was on the ground, and I just didn't know what to say. And she told me what had happened to her. She'd had meningococcal, and she just returned from, come back from London, I think, was studying law, was dating, all these things which I'd assumed would I could never do again, because I only had these stereotypes in my head of what life with a disability was all about. And shame on me for eating up all of the bullshit stereotypes that media had fed me for so many years. Life with a disability meant that I had no chance of X, Y, and Z for the rest of my life. I had to be this sad little shell of a human for the rest of my life. And Phoebe just turned all of that around and proved it all wrong. She left, and all of a sudden I'm like, oh, it doesn't have to be like that.
Oh, that's amazing.
So it was, yeah, suddenly there was this newfound hope that I can actually turn things around. So all of that changed, and of course I had my bad days and things like that, but still do, of course, I'm only human. And ever since then, things like finding a routine have really helped me. So even in hospital, I would still have my routine. I would get up every morning, have my breakfast, have my coffee, go to the, I called it the gym, but it was just the rehab facility, and do my little exercises, and remembering that I was pretty pissed weak, so I could only like lift an arm, and I was doing something, and so, yep, you know, punch a balloon or something like that. It was pretty small stuff. And so having those sorts of routines and things to look forward to, and those sorts of little things kept me going, and having things to look forward to, even if it was just going outside for 5 minutes to watch the sunset over the highway. Really silly, small, silly things like that.
Well, oh, I didn't, they're think not silly. Funny. Not yeah, silly.
They meant something at the time.
So after a year, you went home. Is that correct?
Yes, I had to move back home with Mum and Dad. So I moved out when I was 21 and I moved to Melbourne to work. And then I moved back home with Mum and Dad.
Now, what was that like going home, I guess, to your real life now, so not in a hospital setting?
Yes.
With your very different medical conditions, I guess you call them?
Very, very different. So for anyone, disability or not, coming back home to live with your parents again is a whole new world. But secondly, coming home to live with your parents who are extra protective of you. I remember Dad, bless his heart, he only had my best interest in mind, and he wanted me to wear a big plastic apron when I was making a cup of coffee to pour the boiling water because he didn't want me to burn himself. And,
yeah. Did you do that?
No. I know. And, yeah, he wanted me to get one of those things that the little old ladies wear. So if you fall, you press the
other buttons.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, they were really, really protective of me. And I completely understand it because they'd seen me for 2 months and they were told they might have to turn off my life support and they didn't know if I was going to live or die. And I understand why they were so, so protective, but it took a lot of me sort of going, it's okay, guys, I'm okay. I sort of had to prove my independence and show that I was okay to be left alone for more than a minute.
Yeah.
And then eventually moved out on my own again after a couple of years, and that was fun. So having my own place and my own space again, that was lovely.
How did you adapt to the physical disabilities?
Mum and Dad's house was not wheelchair friendly. It was a two-story brick.
Okay.
And I just didn't go upstairs, basically. I just stayed downstairs. Unfortunately, there was a built-in bathroom down there and I just made downstairs, turned the living room into my bedroom, and there were things down there that I could set up, I suppose, turned the entirety of downstairs into my living quarters, I suppose. I'm incredibly, incredibly grateful that I was in a position to be able to do that. There was no NDIS back then as well, so there was no sort of option for home modifications or anything.
So there was no support?
No, nothing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
This was sort of been 14 years ago, so yeah, pre-NDIS.
How about in terms of prosthetics? Is that the same? Because they're not cheap, are they?
Yeah, no, I'm very fortunate these days that's NDIS funded. Same with my wheelchair. My wheelchair and my prosthetics are the only things, the only, I suppose, daily equipment that I need. So there are things that I do need from time to time, like I suppose a shower chair is something that I do use every day. But in terms of things that I use every second of the day to mobilise, prosthetic leg and a wheelchair is something that I have on me constantly.
Was there a particular time that it kind of hit you that this is what your life was going to be like, or was it gradually as everything kind of happened?
I think gradually, but to be honest, it must have been gradually. It seems like such a blur. Sometimes it feels like, this is going to sound like a strange answer, this is the way it's always been, but at the same time, I have such a clear recollection of my old life that I know that's not true, but this feels so normal to me now. I'm like, well, of course this is the way my hands have always been. Of course I don't see clearly. Of course I don't drive.
I know exactly what you mean. It's like you've had two lives.
There's very distinct before and after point. I was reading something the other day, a friend of mine, Lindsay Knott, who's a quadriplegic, and he had an accident when he was a teenager, and it was the age at which he had been alive, he'd been alive longer than the halfway point. So I had the accident when I was 24, so when I'm like maybe 49 or something, maybe I'll sort of go, shit, Okay. So now it's it has been a while now. Up until this point, it's always been like, I've only been disabled for a little bit of my life, but I don't know. Maybe I'll think differently about it. I have no idea. But like I said, it's for the moment anyway. It seems like this is all I know, but I do have such a clear recollection of my old life at the same time.
You come across as such a positive person, even though all of this stuff has happened to you. Have you always been like that? Have you always been a positive person? Or do you think it's because of what's happened to you that you now love life and see the opportunity in everything?
Oh, I'd like to think I was always like that. I've always... Well, firstly, I have plenty of bad days too.
Yeah, we all do.
I'm not always positive. I hate positive Pollyanna toxicity.
I don't mean that at all. I mean the fact that you're not going, woe is me, sorry for myself all the time.
No. I'd like to think I was always like that. I've always been a huge fan of positive, without getting too woo about the whole thing, surrounding myself with positive people. And
maybe it's more so being grateful. Maybe that's a better way of putting it, being so grateful for everything.
I'm grateful and always have been grateful as fuck. I'm sorry for swearing for so many things. And I wrote an article about this years ago because that was one of the things that got me through my first year in hospital, was just being so, so grateful for, I had so much to be miserable about, but shit, I had a lot to be grateful for. Yes, I was in a really bad way, but I was getting 3 meals a day. I was in an air-conditioned room in Brisbane summer, and anyone who lives in Brisbane through summer knows how awesome that is. And, you know, 3 meals a day, tell a kid in the middle of somewhere in a third world country that, you know, 3 meals a day is really, really bad. And like, I don't want to get into this horrible comparison thing and start, it just turns into a minefield. But I think too often we just fall down this wall as me trap and stop and don't look at our privilege.
So why is it important for you to not be seen as a victim?
Because I don't see myself, first I don't see myself as a victim. I don't want people to treat me as a victim, and I don't want other disabled people to think that's how they have to see themselves.
That's a perfect way of going into the next bit about what you do now with your life. So you are a huge disability advocate.
Yes.
How did you get into doing that?
When I first acquired my disabilities, I swore that I was never, ever, ever going to be a disability advocate.
Oh, really?
Ever, ever, ever. Didn't want to borrow it, because all I knew about disability advocates was that they were mean and scary and swore a lot. I do that, but they just were really, really scary, horrible, nasty people.
Well, that's not you.
It's not true at all. It's not true at all.
So what changed?
Well, I realized that I can do it my way, and I didn't have to be a nasty person on Twitter who just screamed and didn't come up with solutions, who only screamed about problems. I could actually work with people to find solutions, and that was my way of doing it. And I didn't see anyone else doing it that way, so I wrongly assumed that it couldn't be done because, well, no one else is doing it that way. So, but after a little bit more searching, I found some people who could work with me doing it that way. So that's the way I've been doing it ever since. And I'm getting a really positive response from brands and businesses who are really resonating with that sort of response, who want to collaborate and want to listen and learn and educate themselves. They do want to sit down and have a conversation. So that's what we're doing.
It's fantastic.
And it is working, and we are getting results. We're doing some really exciting things that haven't been done before. And that's awesome. That's what we wanted to see.
So I guess something like that hadn't been done before happened a few weeks ago at Australian Fashion Week. Can you take us through what happened and your take on it? Because there's been quite a bit of backlash that I've heard, and I don't think that is your take at all. So can you talk to us about that?
Ah, that chestnut. Yeah, so for any of your listeners who mightn't be across it, Australian Fashion Week, just for a bit of context, never ever in the history of Australian Fashion Week had Australian Fashion Week featured disability ever. Designers, models, anything had never been included. And I had been speaking with Australian Fashion Week behind the scenes publicly as well, trying to convince them to sort of make some ground and pointing out some really quite shocking examples. The fact that all over the world, Milan, Paris, New York, wheelchairs, prosthetics, people with visible disabilities had been used on runways for years and years. It was really no big deal. But Australia, as much as we like to think that we're progressive and forward-thinking, and still refused to go there. It was really quite embarrassing, I think. I was bringing this to their attention time and time again, and they asked me to come on board as a consultant with another designer, Nikki Hind from Blind Grit, and we were consultants with IMG behind the scenes to make the event itself more accessible so that people with a disability could come to the event and actually access it. We did have other ideas to discuss with them, but that will be for future planning because some of those ideas were too close to the event. We did also discuss panels and things like that. So I was on a panel about diversity and inclusion in the fashion industry with a queer model, a First Nations designer, a magazine editor. I'm trying to think who else. No, we're talking about diversity and inclusion in the fashion industry, why it's important, how it can be improved. I, of course, was there looking at it through a disability lens. And then it was quite a surprise to me that they also asked me to take part in the finale and close the 2021 Australian Fashion Week. So I'd planned to just be a consultant behind the scenes, get other people onto the catwalk, and never expecting to actually be on the catwalk myself. So when they asked me to be, it was as much a surprise to me as anybody else. So yeah, that's what I did. I was there with three other visibly disabled models. And I say visibly disabled because I'm sure there are models out there with invisible disabilities like anxiety or depression or something, but we can't obviously see that. So there were three other models out there with missing limbs and one other in a wheelchair. And I was closing the show, so I was the final model out there in a Camilla gown. And they put some, it's like shredded paper basically, put that out on the runway. And they did consult me. They said, Lisa, can you wheel on this? I did a practice.
Yes, they did ask you.
They did ask me and I did a practice. All right, yep, that's fine. But when 20 or 30 or 40, however many models walk over it, paper moves. Yeah. So by the time I got out there at the very, very end, paper had moved and it got stuck in my caster wheels. And for non-wheelchair users, they're those small wheels at the front. So it got stuck in my wheels, which meant that on my way back down the runway, I got stuck. I couldn't move. And Camilla Franks, the designer, jumped up out of her seat and had to come and push me back down the runway. Now, I thought nothing of it because any of your listeners in wheelchairs know that this stuff happens all the time. We always get caught on things and my arms were in the air. I was having the time of my life. I just didn't care. I just thought it was funny. It happens all the time. I was too busy laughing, to be honest, and high-fiving Camilla, and then just go off and I think I swore again. And then I woke up the next morning and, oh my God, the internet had lost its little mind. Everybody was, oh my God. And firstly, people were just bullying Camilla and saying it was all her fault. And it had nothing to do with that beautiful woman. It had absolutely nothing to do with her. It wasn't her fault at all. She was there to dress me, not the runway. Very, very important. And IMG have since issued a statement to say, our bad, our fault, not Camilla's fault. So I wrote a piece for Mamma Mia. Actually, wrote a piece on Instagram, actually, and they wrote a piece for Mamma Mia. You know, it wasn't my place to, or up to me to defend Camilla. She's big enough brand and a big enough name to come out and defend herself. But I certainly don't like bullying at all. And I thought, this is not fair. I'm this big and Camilla is this big. Little of me just thought, well, what the heck? I'll defend her anyway because, hey, I was there. If anyone knows what happened, it's going to be me, not some random on the other side of Australia who wasn't even there, who just saw a tweet that was retweeted from somebody else.
It seems like it's taken away as well from how big of a event this was, that it was the first time that disabilities were shown on the runway.
It was so disappointing, and I was really, really, really disappointed, actually, that it did take away from something that should have been celebrated so much, instead of celebrating the fact that for the first time ever this had happened. Everyone was getting so fixated on some paper in a wheel. Let's get some perspective. I have seen for years and years and years everyone talking about the need for change, the need for change. Finally, we get some change. No one wants to talk about it. Everyone wants to talk about some paper caught in my wheel. Come on, guys. Really?
Yeah.
Yes, I'm not minimizing the fact that accessibility is an incredibly important issue. Of course that's important. It's extremely important. But that is going to be talked about. I'm talking with journalists at the moment about that. Let that run its course. Trust me. That will be dealt with. But let's not lose sight of the fact that this is a really, really big thing. Let's not put the likes of Australian Fashion Week offside from doing more in the future, because one way to put them offside is to just shit all over them the minute they do try. And that's what they've done. They have legitimately tried, and I can honestly say they've done a really, really good job of it. Yes, they made a mistake. No one is doubting a mistake was made. We all know a mistake was made. They put their hand up and said, we made a mistake.
Yeah.
Okay, they did. We all learned from it. And I've said that many, many times. If you read back through my old Instagram posts, we all make mistakes, we all F up. You learn from it, you grow from it, you move on from it. And that's what will happen. So it's going to be better next year or the year after.
How much do you think that things have changed since you had the brain hemorrhage to now in terms of diversity and showing disabilities and all of this sort of thing? Has it come a long way or not so much?
It has, but it's got a long way to go. I've been having conversations with people about this for years and years and years. I remember when I first started talking to people about getting disability included in Australian Fashion Week, I was either laughed at or had some eyebrows raised and was told, oh, you silly girl. It's certainly got a long way to go. I'm not saying it's all done. There's a long way to go. But it has come a long way. I'm not just talking about the runways of Australian Fashion Week. The same thing applies to all sorts of popular culture. So if we look at the representation of disabled people in media, in movies, Hollywood, all of those sorts of things, in advertising. Advertising media is, and marketing is my background professionally, so I could bore you with that sort of stuff all day. But Media Diversity Australia is another organisation that I work for. We've got some exciting projects underway at the moment looking at the representations of disability in media, specifically in newsrooms across Australia.
Okay.
Looking to launch that towards the end of the year. Those are the sorts of things that I'm really, really focused on, more so than fashion. Fashion's one of those things that only comes up every now and again, every so often in the season. But media marketing and advertising is more of a constant throughout the year.
But you have achieved so much since you had your brain injury. So you're a published writer, you're a professional speaker, you're obviously a disability advocate that we've been speaking about and a model, and you've written two books amongst a whole heap of other things that you're doing. Is there a particular article, book, event you've been involved in or anything like that that you're particularly proud of?
I've written a few things recently about diversity in the media, and I know I wrote one a little while ago about why the media industry is failing, and it was published in Fox, CBS and CNN.
Oh.
Picked it up. And, yeah, why the media is failing, essentially the fact that it's not representing the wider communities, because when I think back to back when I was a young'un, so a long, long time ago, there were no remotes. You just had to put up with bad content. There were no streaming services. You had to put up with it or turn off the TV and go and play outside. That was it. Mm-hmm. The point of the article was that, you know, the media is failing because all these streaming services are out there and people are just consuming content that they relate to. And all the streaming services are offering content with more diversity. They're offering content with characters that reflect our community, reflect our society, greater diversity of skin tones and ethnicity and disability and all of those sorts of things which the mainstream channels just aren't providing. And so that's one of the reasons why the media industry is failing. And another piece that I wrote 2018, I think, but it's still relevant today, and it was all about what we're missing in the diversity debate, because we only ever think of colour and gender, and so often we miss disability in this discussion around diversity. And I see that so often. A couple of the groups I work with, unfortunately, it's like disability is sort of the forgotten cousin sometimes in these really big discussions around diversity. It's about culture first and gender pay gaps and those sorts of things. It's, disability, we'll tack that on to the end.
What are some things that you've learnt from your whole experience?
One thing I'm still learning is to be more patient, and I'm really shit at it. I'm terrible. I'm still learning is to be more patient. I'm so bad at that. I have learned to take, I don't know if it's old age or disability, to take less bullshit and give fewer fucks. I turned 41 the other day or the other month. I don't know if it's sort of getting a bit older or just not caring.
Life experience.
Life experience. One of the two.
Right. And what does the future hold for you?
Hopefully more of the same. I'm pretty bloody happy with life right now, and hopefully we can travel again soon, because I want to get back to seeing people overseas and everything like that. But more of the same, back writing and traveling and with my dog. Yeah, got a puppy about 10 months ago and just love him to death.
Oh, and how can our listeners connect with you and your work?
That would be Instagram's probably the best, but I've got different platforms, but the only one I spend any time on is really Instagram. So at lisacox.co, LASACOX.co. That's also my website, lisacox.co.
I'll put that in the show notes as well as her Instagram page. And all your articles are on your website, aren't they? Or some of them.
Most of them, yes.
And so one last question before we leave this. If you could go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be? I ask everyone this question.
You're stronger than you think.
Oh, I like that.
No, I think it was Eleanor Roosevelt who said it. I don't know if that was her. I stole it from somebody.
No, you've definitely proved that though, haven't you? I can't believe what you've achieved. Amazing.
Oh, thank you. None of us think we can do anything when we're, if you told me any of this before it all happened, told me that I'd end up in a wheelchair and one leg and 25% blind, but I would meet this guy and do this stuff, I just would have gone, not a chance. So we're all stronger than we think.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For taking your time to speak to me today. And you've done so well with your fatigue as well. Can't even notice. You're so inspiring. Like, seriously, keep doing what you're doing. And yeah, you're making so much change in the community and advocating for so many people, which is just fantastic. So thank you so much. And all the best for everything in the future.
Thank you very much.
If you enjoyed this episode, I'd be so grateful if you could please hit 5 stars and leave a review, or take a screenshot and share it on social media so that we can reach and inspire more people. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you won't miss any future episodes. And I look forward to you joining me for the next episode of the Inspirational Tales podcast.